Thank you so much again, Sophie, for being so open. Kirsty as well for helping us just hear a little bit of Sophie's story. And I guess her story may well be quite similar to some of yours listening in. It's been a very strange year, hasn't it? And as Paul's already said, that's why we wanted to put this evening on, to have a chance just to explain a little bit of the Christian hope that is found within troubles, and also to give a chance for you to ask your questions of us as best you can using that form. I know nothing replaces the opportunity to be together physically. I really lament the fact we can't welcome you into the building we rent and see you, see the hands go up, talk with you over tea and coffee afterwards. So we'll have to make do mediated through a screen. I mean, I get to be surrounded by my books, which is always a nice thing for me. But I'd love to hear from you at the end of the talk if you wanted to ask any questions that you have. It is fair to say, though, isn't it? And I guess at this point, here's a spot where everyone listening can probably agree that this has been an unusual year. It's been an unusually anxious year within an age that's already been described by some secular psychologists as an age of anxiety. But something about 2020 has already and probably will in posterity go down as a year with loads and loads of factors to do that. I thought we'd begin just with a little bit of a collage through the screen of various images that people have sent me to sum up 2020 for them. I asked a range of family and friends of all sorts of different faith positions and none, and what picture would sum things up for them? If you're listening and your picture hasn't made it in, forgive me, I enjoyed and was moved by a number of them. Here's just a little bit of the most striking ones. Here's the first one. One of the most frequent images that I either received or had described to me was that of this year being like a storm or a whirlpool. Here's one that a friend of mine who works pastorally with students in St. Andrews through the university sent through. The second one, the next couple, in fact, speak to the changes in our lives that the COVID-19 pandemic has brought. Here's a mate who's the director of a company who said that the past 7 months have basically been spent on Microsoft Teams. That's not product placement for Microsoft. We're on Zoom right now, and lots of other people will have used lots of other different platforms, but loads of time on screen. Here's another change. We move from the screen to a street. You may well recognize it. We could have a quick quiz in the hall if we were together. There's the Royal Mile, totally bare, and a very eerie image for anyone even passingly acquainted with Edinburgh, where you would expect that to be teeming with tourists from all over the world. Here it is, where you could basically play a cricket match on it. Away from COVID, though, it's not just been COVID, is it, that's been bothering us. There have been profound environmental concerns that have come to the fore this year. Here's a horrifying image that kind of blends COVID in the sign, but with the terrible bushfires that went on in Australia. There have been all sorts of terrible things that we've seen that in the wake of the relentless news cycle, it would be easy to forget. Others, though, have summed up the year with what we could say is a more humorous approach. And we need humour, don't we? We need to be able to laugh. Here are a few cartoons and memes that I received, which I thought I'd stick together. You could have a look and tell me through the form if you want which your favourite one is. I quite like the breaking news alerts in my dreams. You might be able to sympathise with that. And yet here is another one, a little bit more personable. Here's my aunt and uncle's parrot caboose getting into the spirit of things with a good clawful of sanitizer. Further on, as we roll on through, here's a friend capturing something of working from home as a teacher, remote learning, not doing it for him, certainly not for the wee one in the picture. But the last one, I think, sums up the lived experience of lots of people. Whoever you are, maybe you can resonate with this. Here's a friend in the States that sent this through. Just too much information in 2020. So many things that might be causing a din in our heads, and perhaps even more profoundly, in our hearts. You see, there are lots of things that bother us, aren't there? There is, of course, COVID. And the Prime Minister's announcement last night for those living in England makes all the rest of us wonder what is going to come. The first lockdown was difficult enough, and now we've got another one, it feels like, at least down south. And who knows what waits for different parts of Scotland or wherever in the world you may be listening to this. We could see political turmoil. I mentioned when chatting with Paul at the start that whatever nationality you are hearing this, my hunch is you could teach us about the political turmoil in your own country. Speaking for many listening, here in Britain, we've got discussions about Brexit. We've got discussions about the lockdown itself. Over in the US, it's election day very shortly, and what is probably the most divided, or at least the most noisily divided, election of the modern era. And there are profound issues to do with our world, with global warming, with the various problems we see around us. And there are always, aren't there, the personal issues, the profound weights that every single heart behind a screen is going to be bearing right now. And all this external noise takes the stress and strain we feel there and maybe just accelerates it to an unbearable pitch. Just a few days ago, on October the 21st, there was a comment article in The Times by Alice Thompson with a range of statistics about the terrible toll on mental health that this year is taking, just in the UK alone. 43% of adults polled would say the pandemic was having a negative impact on their mental health. The Office of National Statistics found that rates of depression have almost doubled, from 1 in 10 to 1 in 5 just in the last 15 months. Amongst the most badly hit are those in the 16-year-old to 39-year-old bracket, which I know lots of people listening are going to be in. A staggering almost 30% of people reporting depressive symptoms. Now we could go on, but my guess is I don't need to persuade you that this is a really serious issue. And let me say right up front, it's really important that you hear me on this if you can, that I am not tonight, and we are not as a church, in any way wanting to be glib about these problems, especially clinical mental health problems. I'm merely citing those numbers to show what is going on. There are many more who may not clinically be in that boat, but are feeling emotions akin to it. And let me say that if you are struggling with your mental health listening to this, please don't struggle in silence or in isolation. It's great to hear Sophie being so honest about it. Please do talk with someone who can support you. And if that someone were to be us as a church, we would love to help you with that and walk you through that. As Sophie said, Christianity, the message and person of Jesus, is not a silver bullet for these things, but rather a profound anchor, the only solid foundation, we would say, with which to wrestle with these problems that are just common to all people. Where we're going for the next few minutes or so is to try and ask the question and answer together why it is we as a race, as humanity, are struggling so much, not just circumstantially, but rather why are we being shaken so profoundly within ourselves. My hope from that point then is to articulate something of a Christian response, for I'm persuaded from that reading earlier that Rachel read to us, as well as many other places, that there is something good and beautiful and true that Jesus says into our lives and our hearts right now. And then after that, there'll be a chance for you guys to type in, send in questions, and then we'll have a time of Q&A where we can knock some of those things around. But first, why are we struggling so much? The obvious thing to say is that there are loads of circumstances that are genuinely upsetting. I guess I don't need to go into that anymore. We've already gone over that ground this evening, haven't we? We only have to open a paper to see them. What I find fascinating in terms of our own humanity is that of the various options on this menu of misery in 2020, there will be some that exert a particular pressure point on our particular hearts. Not everyone is going to be equally exercised by every single problem that besets them. And yet there are many, aren't there? And so wherever our particular buttons are pressed, we are under pressure this year. I want to go a step further, though, and say that it's not merely circumstantial. Obviously, the presenting problems are what we see around us. But anxiety and uncertainty and fear is common to humanity, isn't it? It's just that it's being experienced in dense packets right now. And what I want to suggest is that the circumstances of 2020 have levered even further apart some of the issues in our hearts that we all individually, but actually as a wider society, hold to. But this year's just churned them up to a serious pitch. But first, I want to suggest, and I'd love you to listen to this critically, and do get in touch through the form if you wanted to push me on any of these. The first problem, I think, is that we place ourselves individually and those nearest to us at the center so often of reality. A kind of self-centeredness can creep into the way we view the world and the way even we view others around us, as almost a myopia that can breed anxiety, that can breed fear, and certainly that often thrives on uncertainty. Have you ever had that experience where you're standing in a queue, maybe? Obviously right now this is going to be less normal, but someone suddenly comes too close to you. They invade your personal space. Some people's personal space is like a force field, kind of 5 meters wide. Others is half a meter. Right now it's a mandated 2. But, you know, when people get closer, we start getting a bit twitchy. Well, it's the same emotionally, isn't it? We've kind of got this emotional force field around us, which when issues press in, we start getting antsy. We get uncomfortable. We get fearful, even. It could be all sorts of things that trigger us in that way. But it's easy to have a mindset that it's me that matters. Or perhaps less overtly selfishly, it's my family, it's those who are nearest and dearest to me. But whatever it is, we can run the risk of putting ourselves bang at the center of all things. And that often will end badly in how we feel. Secondly, a little bit more broadly, we might say that not only do we place ourselves at the center of reality, we place humanity at the center and make our fellow people ultimate. Now, that will sound and is in some ways less selfish or less self-centered than putting us at the heart. But we could say it's less egocentrism, me-centeredness, and just person-centeredness. So that if you're like this and you put other people at the top, you will be very anxious about the problems that are happening in the realm of social justice. It could well be that the Black Lives Matters and protests are something that causes you real either hope or pain, depending on how things have been going. You would look at the plight of the poor, and that would break your heart. Let me say, and hopefully you'll see this as we've been going on already, these are good things. It is a good thing to want dignity and equality for people. It is a good thing to desire justice for people. And yet, why do they cause us such grief? Well, because we're making those things ultimate and of supreme importance. And it's this third one I'm about to suggest that I think intersects with those first two to make the concerns we see in this world of ultimate importance. And it is that we live as though this world is all there is. The fact that we can make health, politics, wealth, and so on and so forth ultimate means that we think there is nothing beyond really this world in which we live. Just here on my shelves, I have a globe, being blessed and privileged to be able to travel a little bit through life. But it can help us as an image of what we do. You see, we've taken this, and rather than saying this is a world that was created by a God to be in relationship with him, we've boxed it off and created a closed system where this is all there is. There is no God. There is no eternal future. There is no heaven nor hell. There are no consequences beyond what we can see and taste and touch. So if it's just this world, then it's just us as people. But when push comes to shove, if it's just us as people, well, it's just me and mine that matter most. It's something that the Bible describes in the language of sin, actually, of getting rid of God and of just turning in on ourselves and saying, no, we don't want that which God has made. We only want the stuff itself. But there have always been, whatever our beliefs are, two supreme things that pierce that closed system we've created. One is profound joy, that moment perhaps where you held your child for the first time. Or think back to that moment of the most profound happiness you can remember. Just a hint that actually there might be more to life than just machines self-replicating. That's one. But the second, and here's where we come back to 2020, is sorrow. You see, the tragedies of our current world, the injustices that we see, the destruction of the world in which we live and we are to steward, those things are shaking our presuppositions, our convictions. And is getting through to us and saying, hang on, maybe there is more to life than this. Think of all the pieces that were written and spoken in the first lockdown about, well, there must be more to life than just the rat race. Must be more to life than just the money one earns. Must be more to life than constantly being on all the time. But the answers we come to, the value systems that we end up settling on again, do they work? Do they get rid of our anxieties? Do they solve our uncertainties? Do they calm our fears? I want to push further now and suggest that as long as we keep looking within ourselves, within other people, or even just within this world for the solution, we will always keep chasing and we will never find peace. Because we as people are broken and we as people are not sufficient to get ourselves out of the hole that we have put ourselves in. And so that the battle, the quest, the pursuit for contentment, for what we might call rest, for peace in the face of our fears, becomes a little bit like Sisyphus. Now, those of you who know me will know I'm a bit of a geek. Those of you who don't know me, you may well know the myth of Sisyphus, the trickster Greek king of Corinth. He was condemned by Zeus to eternal labor, always working, never resting. So if you are in a Sisyphean task, it means you're just constantly trying something that you will never succeed at. And here's a picture for our day of Sisyphus. He's not just pushing a rock up a mountain. He's pushing a masked world. I'm sure that Boris Johnson or insert world leader here would sympathize with Sisyphus right there. But I wonder if you think that diagnosis is right, that we will never achieve happiness, that we will never actually be able to find rest ourselves, that like Sisyphus, that particular rock will never get to the mountaintop, but will always roll away. Doesn't that sound a little bit bleak? The French philosopher and novelist Albert Camus, he thought that that was bleak, but he also thought it was true. Look at what he says just for a little bit in his work, The Myth of Sisyphus. He says, in a universe suddenly divested of illusion and lights, our closed system world again, man feels an alien, stranger. His exile is without remedy since he is deprived of the memory of a lost home or the hope of a promised land. He says, you've not come from anywhere special. You're not going anywhere special. There's no God above you. There's no king to walk beside you, like Sophie was so movingly saying. This is it. But his conclusion, I find staggering. He says, one must imagine Sisyphus happy. He said, the only way to find rest and happiness is to embrace the futile absurdity of life. That's where a world without God goes, Camus says. Hopeless reality and imagined contentment. Now, is that too bleak for you? Or does that chime with your experience of reality? You see, I want to say tonight that the anxiety we feel, the uncertainty we grapple with, the fear that we fight against, are actually signs to us that all is not as it should be. Even more so that this world is not actually all there is, because the uncertainties and anxieties and fears show us that this world has gone profoundly wrong. We don't know how to explain it ourselves often. We just alight on the problem that we personally find most distressing. And we say, if we solve that, well, then we're going to be better. So the great ill might be Brexit, or it might be climate change. But then others would say, no, that the great danger is COVID, or others might say lockdown. And on we go in ever diminishing circles of ever increasing bitterness and backbiting, but ultimately desperation, because we want a way out. And like a child afraid in the dark, assailed by terrors, looking for comfort, but it feels like their father or mother is miles away and isn't coming. It's like the night just goes on forever. And in that reality, all we can do is imagine happiness. Now, do tell me through the form, ask a question if you think that I've got this wrong or I'm painting an overly broad brushstroke. So I'm conscious we've got short time and we can't cover everything in detail. But it strikes me that to view our world as just a closed system, that's it, is ultimately inherently hopeless, because it does mean that any change is held below the waterline. If my only hope is in this world, then the solution is of this world, and this world is broken. If my only hope is in people as they are, and so I look there for change, well, people are broken, aren't they? I mean, take politics. John Gray, the philosopher, said politics is a succession of temporary and partial remedies for permanent and recurring human evil. Not cheery to take to the ballot box, but accurate. Even more scarily, at our nearest concentric circle, if my only centre is me, and if my only hope is in the change I can bring, well, then not only am I stuffed, but everyone else is, because I am broken on my own. Rejecting God and going my own way into the dark. Now, when the Bible speaks of this as sin, it's really honest, but in a way I think that is bracing and actually profoundly liberating. It doesn't patronize. It's not self-hating. It's rather coolly accurate. For this is the state of humanity. Jesus himself would say that, and you could read one of the Gospels to check that I'm not pulling the wool over your eyes. And the wonderful news of a good diagnosis, of saying, no, we have gone our own way, is that actually a good diagnosis from a good doctor can lead to true change and to true hope. You see, we long for rest. We can't find it ourselves. So where then can we find something that is more than an imagined happiness, but is a true rest for our souls? Well, it's at this point that I would say we need to turn to Jesus himself. You see, not just to ask what's gone wrong, but our second and final major heading tonight, where can we find peace? Now, I'd love to hear from you, what you make of Jesus right now, conscious that what we've said already tonight, especially Sophie and her story and some of what I've already spoken about, rest on a whole range of assumptions about who Jesus is, that we can know him. You see, the Christian faith would say that he is the God-man, the one who entered into our sorrows to restore a broken world by saving a broken and sinful humanity, by taking on ourselves the condemnation that we deserve, to bring us to know God. Now, you may well not share that belief as you listen to this. You're hugely welcome, and please ask those questions. But whoever you are, my hunch is you would at least acknowledge Jesus as a fine and compassionate teacher. And that's why I think it's important that we consider what Rachel read to us earlier from Matthew's Gospel, one of the four collections of eyewitness accounts about Jesus's life. He speaks there a lot about anxiety. Here it is on the screen with the stuff about anxiety picked out. Five times, do you see? He's speaking to his followers and he says, don't be anxious. Which of you by being anxious can add a single hour? Why are you anxious? Do not be anxious. Now, Jesus isn't hectoring us here. He's a wise and realistic person and pastor. He knows that we are anxious about the things of this world. For them, then, it was about food and clothes. Where are we going to be fed and how are we going to be clothed? My hunch is that for many listening, those aren't the things of this world that press in and cause you fear, but rather it's the things we've already been talking about tonight, to which we could add concerns about our careers or our mortgages or the children's schooling or our pension or our care at the end of life. Important things, good things, but not ultimate things. You notice that Jesus doesn't say they're wrong. He affirms in this whole passage that we do need them. But rather, he orients us away. Look at what he does say. He says, do not be anxious. But how can he? Well, the next slide shows it, because he says there is not just this world. It is not just you. It's not just people at the center. This is the world of one who is a heavenly father. for all who know Jesus. There is a God, the God, who rules over all. And he says, everyone else, the Gentiles, it's just a technical word in those days for those who weren't Jewish, here for those who don't believe in this God and Father. He says, look, the world seeks after all these things, the things of this world. But your heavenly Father knows you need them all. He says the deepest reality is not a world on its own, but a loving, fatherly God who rules over it all. He redraws reality for them so that they and we, if we would listen to him, are not mini Sisyphuses toiling up an endless slope, but rather those who can rest and trust in the care of God. He applies it in the very last sentence of this little bit of this Sermon on the Mount. And you'll see it on the next slide. He says, do not live in this world as though you are all there is. Rather, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. Seek God and his kingdom. Now, two thoughts, if you could just hold that in your mind. On the one hand, this is a wonderful thing to say. Isn't it a lovely idea to say, look, pursue God and know him as Father. And so don't be anxious. If you could take that, as it were, to the bank of the heart now, wouldn't you do it in a flash? No anxiety and a true pursuit of true reality. That'd be brilliant. But a second thought, maybe not far behind that, which is, how dare Jesus say that? Who is he to say, don't be anxious? Doesn't he know about Sophie's pain? Doesn't he know about ours? Doesn't he know about yours? The myriad hurts that are going to be represented down the other end of the internet from me right now. Doesn't he know that? Doesn't he know? The philosopher John Gray, who I mentioned earlier, just published a book about cats, about how cats can tell us the meaning of life. And one of his takeaways is, don't live as though there was an imagined future. He may well say of this, pie in the sky, of course you want to believe it, but get real, Hamish. You can't. If that's you, please do talk to us and push me on that. How can we know true rest in the face of this? Well, it comes through an even more staggering doubling down of what Jesus says. Later on in Matthew's Gospel, in chapter 11, he says this. You can see it on the screen there in front of you. I just want to highlight those bottom lines. Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Jesus says we can know rest because he uniquely is the one who brings us to this Father. All things, he says, have been given to me by my Father. No one knows the Son except the Father. No one knows the Father except the Son. And anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal him. And then he says, if you want to know that Father who banishes anxiety, come to me, trust in me. So let me ask you, does that last verse describe you this evening? Are you laboring and heavy laden? Jesus says, come to me and I will give you rest. Are your souls weary? Well, Jesus says, come to me and you will find rest for your souls. I love those little words in the middle. Jesus says, learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart. He is a king, truly, as Sophie mentioned, who will walk beside us in humility. Compare Jesus here to the CVs of our worldly leaders. This may not get very far in an election campaign, and that tells us everything about our world. Because here we see everything about the heart of Jesus Christ for you, for me, for any who would take him at his word. He showed it by dying in our place, going to the most lowly of places, even bearing hell itself on our behalf. So that anyone who lays hold of him, even with a faint and anxious and fluttering hand, that anyone can know rest. Well, our time is up. just want us to close by asking you two questions. Would you want this to be true? Would you want it to be true that there is one who bears your burdens for you? It doesn't mean that we'll never feel anxiety. So important to say that. But it does mean that here is the rock on which we can rest while we face the uncertainties of this terrible year and whatever else is to come. Knowing a good father, having an eternal perspective, with our hand held by the one who beat the grave himself. So there's one question. Would you like this to be true? And secondly, if you would say it's not, a one-word question, why? Why do you say that? Please do chat with us if you'd like to, ask questions. You may even want to sign up for that Christianity Explored course Paul mentioned, and we'll give a few more details for later. Just a safe space to ask any questions and to go a little bit deeper on some of the stuff we haven't been able to cover now. As I said at the start, Christianity, Jesus himself, does not present a silver bullet. And if even listening to this, you've been churned up a bit with your own battles and sorrows, please just don't bear them on your own. We'd love to serve you if we could with them. But above all, not on my authority, but on Jesus himself, I would say take him at his word. Go to him, for he is gentle and lowly, and he will give you rest for your soul and for ours.